18-2073 United States v. Ford. Mr. Villa?
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Villa and I represent the appellant Stephen Ford. And his appeal concerns the two conditions of supervised release that were imposed by the district court following his resentencing on a successful petition for resentencing after United States v. Johnson. And the two conditions of release that were imposed were what I describe as sex offender conditions of release, or the first being that he undergo an assessment for a sex offender evaluation to determine if he needs treatment, and the second condition being that if he needs treatment, he must undergo the treatment, including the condition that he undergo polygraph examinations. Those were objected to to the district court, and the district court overruled the objections and imposed them. And I think this case is very similar to the case United States versus Dugan, in which this court found that conditions like those for someone not being convicted of a sex offense in the instant case were not reasonably related to the crime of conviction or the statutory sentencing, applicable statutory sentencing directives.
There's some suggestion in our cases and by the government that we should, you know, this ripeness issue, that we ought to wait until it's a little closer to the imminency of the condition being executed. That would counsel waiting and reaching a merits ruling. What's your response to that?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree. I think that although I grant that this court has exercised the prudential ripeness doctrine in one case, United States versus Vaquera Juanes, I believe, in the situation where the defendant was being deported, and in United States versus Bennett, in another case in which the issue of whether the actual testing that was being ordered was even going to be available. And I think that those two cases perhaps should stand out on an island, because I think that it's our position the prudential ripeness doctrine really doesn't have a place in criminal cases. It's rarely applied in criminal cases. And when you look at the factors in United States versus Wayne from this court in 2010, those factors, I think, almost exclusively warrant a decision at the time. And I think that, I mean, I'm happy to go through that analysis now. There is, I should alert the court, Ms. Ong alerted this to me yesterday, the United States is going to seek to supplement the record in this case. So one of the issues that was raised by the United States with the ripeness doctrine was
The murder charge?
Pending murder charge. Mm-hmm. And it turns out in late December, Mr. Ford pleaded guilty to that murder charge and was given a life sentence.
How do you think that bears on the analysis then?
Well, it certainly changes it, but I think I would stick to my position that, assuming this is true, we just have the docket.
We'll assume for now.
Yeah, from the internet. We don't actually have the pleadings, but let's assume that that information on the docket is accurate. I don't know whether it changes it or not. I mean, it's certainly closer. I would have to admit it's closer to...
That's a federal conviction?
It was a state conviction.
Is there a possibility of parole? I mean, I guess I'm asking you to speculate a little bit, but is there a possibility he'll ever be released from prison?
According to the entry on the docket, it says life without the possibility of parole. Now, I've seen docket entries that aren't accurate, so of course I'd like to see the judgment itself, but it's interesting. This is the second case you've heard today where someone pled guilty to a life without the possibility of parole. And one thing I can think of that somebody might do that is if they were facing the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
This is Oklahoma. They have the death penalty. I've scanned this docket many times and scanned it again this morning, and there wasn't any indication that this was a death penalty case, but I suppose that could have come into the negotiations.
It just seems pretty remote then that this condition would ever be triggered.
Well, I suppose if that's true, although I wonder if we find ourselves in a situation where at some point Mr. Ford appeals his judgment. I mean, the judgment was entered in late December. I don't know the time.
That's true. I suppose he could get pardoned someday, right?
He could. I mean, it's not like Vaquero where there's a deportation and the person isn't going to come back to the country, in theory.
Mm-hmm.
Or Bennett, where we don't even know that this testing that they wanted Mr. Bennett to do 10 years down the road was even going to be available. And so I think it's a little bit of a different situation. If we get into the business of saying, well, maybe this person's going to get a sentencing reduction or get pardoned or appeal or, you know, file a habeas petition saying their counsel was ineffective for having them plead guilty to a life sentence. And in this guessing game, I think it just doesn't make sense in the context of a criminal case to exercise the prudential rightness.
And it's your position that to preserve the challenge to the special conditions, he had to appeal it now.
I think he has to. I think the case law is clear.
The case law is clear that you can't reserve that.
You got to object and you've got to file your notice of appeal. So, you know, the prudential rightness doctrine, it's sort of ironic. It's about judicial efficiency. Yet, you know, at what point do we get there? So you object, you file your notice of appeal, and then I suppose if there were a rule in place, the government could file a motion or something to sort of avoid having to do all the briefing and get here for oral argument and try to save some, you know, judicial economy. But it just doesn't seem to make sense if the rule is you have to object, you have to file your notice of appeal, and it's not until the government files their answer brief that they raise this issue, and then we decide, you know, other than the court writing the opinion, whether it's judicially efficient not to make a decision. And I think that, you know, we're dealing with, when we talk about the five factors in Wayne, we're dealing with case or controversy jurisdiction. That's the first issue, so that's clear. The second factor from Wayne is, are these issues that are legal, that can be easily resolved without reference to concrete facts? And I think that they can be resolved. We're just talking about, I mean, if you set aside length of time somebody might be in prison, you know, we're just talking about, are these conditions reasonably related given Mr. Ford's crime of conviction and his past history and circumstances? So I think that's easy. The hardship, that's number three. Would the defendant experience a hardship if there's not a ruling? Well, I guess in theory, if he does life in prison, perhaps. But I still think there are these situations where if he appeals, if he succeeds on a habeas petition, if he's pardoned, well, then he's going to experience a hardship because he's going to have to start following these conditions of release.
He could challenge him at the time. I think that was the point of Bennett, that you could move to modify the conditions at the time of their application.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that one of the things in Bennett was, well, let's see if in 10 years when Mr. Bennett gets out, this type of testing that they wanted him to do was even available. Maybe he doesn't even have to move to modify it. The concern I have with Mr. Ford's condition, at least number 9, is that he has to go do a sex offender assessment. He's got no choice. And I think there can be a hardship.
The polygraph part of that's contingent, though, isn't it?
It is. If the assessment says you need treatment, then he has to do whatever treatment is recommended by the assessment, and it may include polygraph. But I think this court has been pretty clear in Van Baron, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that could implicate Fifth Amendment rights. But, you know, taking it back to the hardship, I think challenging it at the time is problematic, and I raise this in my reply brief, in whether he has the right to assistance of counsel. You know, certainly if he violates a condition of release and is facing a petition to revoke his supervision, he's going to get counsel. But if he's simply on supervised release and is told by his probation officer, you need to go do this assessment, he wants to challenge it, I'm not sure he has, at least as an indigent defendant, the right to the appointment of counsel. I guess that area is a little unclear for me. Certainly could hire counsel, but then I guess the issue is he's got to come back here because the district court has already overruled his objection. So what happens in this interim time period that he's trying to perfect the appeal or get this case back in front of this court, and he's still having to execute the sentence? So I think that does create a hardship for him.
Can I ask you a question? Thank you for the conversation on that. Does the record reveal whether he received a required sex offender assessment as a part of the Kansas conviction?
It doesn't state it explicitly. Essentially, probation in the pre-sentence report could not find any evidence that he had ever done any sex offender treatment.
Well, he escaped, right?
That's right. So he wasn't
released in the normal way.
So there's a little bit of a gap. He pleads guilty to this, what I would call a statutory rape. I mean, granted, he was charged with more serious. It appears this indecent liberties under Kansas law is sort of akin to that, and I think that was just part of the plea bargaining process. But he pleads guilty to that, and there's a little bit of a gap, and then he's convicted of a robbery, and he goes to prison. He escapes from prison and comes to New Mexico, where he gets the charges that he's... And so he's never been out. And it wasn't clear whether he had any such treatment in prison.
Or whether he was facing that as a special condition for the state conviction.
That's right. If he got into some sort of probation pursuant to the Kansas conviction or the Oklahoma conviction, now that he's got this Oklahoma conviction, whether he's going to have that type of probation. But I think that can have an effect too. You know, this isn't in the record, but, you know, if there's this judgment and sentence that says you need to do sex offender treatment, and you're in prison, I suppose the prison could say in Oklahoma, well, you need sex offender treatment. This federal judge in New Mexico said you did, so we're going to have you do sex offender treatment in our Oklahoma prison. And I think that's another reason not to exercise the prudential rightness, even when you have someone in prison, is oftentimes the prison's treatment or placement of a person or other things may depend on potential court orders that are out there. And so I think that's, you know, especially in the criminal context when we're facing these situations where someone's either going to go to prison or probation, and in theory the idea is rehabilitation, maybe there isn't if it's life in prison, that these judgments can have an effect on that person's period of incarceration. And so I think... Just to finish up these weighing factors, you know, the traditional canons of construction or of abstention, I guess, or prudential rightness don't apply in the supervised release context very cleanly. That was one of the reasons, I think, in Wayne that they didn't exercise the prudential rightness doctrine. And I think dealing with it immediately rather than waiting for a violation, that was sort of the fifth factor that Wayne looked at. And I think that's... Right. I mean, I brought up the idea of, well, if he doesn't violate, then he has to undergo the condition. But, you know, if we say, well, we'll just wait and see if he violates, you sort of create this almost incentive to violate your condition of release so that you can challenge whether that condition is reasonable. And I see that I'm down to about 2 minutes. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly. Welcome back.
Good morning again, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Marissa Ong, and I'm an Assistant United States Attorney in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Counsel? Just to touch on the ripeness matter, as Mr. Villa alluded to, by way of prepping for this argument today, I did look up the Oklahoma docket sheet for Ford's murder case. And the docket does indicate that he pled guilty on December 14th, 2017, and that on December 22nd, there's an entry that shows there was a judgment sentencing him to life without the possibility of parole. So I will be moving to supplement the record in this case as soon as I obtain a copy of that judgment, and I believe this court can take judicial notice of that. Assuming that's the case, I think that this case definitely is not ripe for review, and I think our strongest case on that point is the Vaquero-Juanes case, where the defendant was going to be deported. And in that case, this court did decide to exercise the prudential ripeness doctrine and specifically found that even though it was undeniable that Vaquero-Juanes' challenge could be easily resolved on the merits, any obtained relief he would have received would have been completely illusory. Review on the merits would have been a waste of judicial resources, because even if he had been successful, even if the Tenth Circuit had found that there was some defect with the conditions, it simply would have wasted judicial resources to send the case back down to the district court for reimposition of conditions of supervised release when none of those conditions were going to have any practical effect on him. And I think that now that's the case that we have here. If he has, in fact, received a sentence without the possibility of parole, he's never going to get out of jail.
And we don't know that. We don't know that. I mean, yeah, he's got the conviction. Yeah, he has a sentence, but maybe he's going to appeal, or maybe he's going to file a habeas, and we just don't know that. And the difference between this case and Vaquera James is that in that case, we knew that he would be removed as soon as he completed his custodial confinement. So there is a distinction here. And there's no real contingency here. The whole idea to me of the prudential ripeness doctrine is that that the claim isn't right because it rests on some contingency. Where here there is a contingency in the one condition, because the one condition is speculative in that we don't know if there's going to be any treatment, right? We don't know if there's any treatment. Condition 9 says he's got to have treatment. Condition 10 says, well, if they recommend treatment, then he's got to have treatment. So that there is a contingency there. But where is the contingency in 9? If he's released, he will have treatment. There's no contingency there.
Well,
if release becomes the contingency, he might not be released because he has another conviction, then you know, how is a case ever going to be ripe? Or if the term of imprisonment itself is the contingency, meaning, gee, it's so long that we just don't know if it's ever going to happen. We might die in prison. I'm bothered that I think you're taking this a little further than the whole idea of the prudential ripeness doctrine.
And I understand that, Judge Moritz, I think our position is that if he has a judgment out of Oklahoma saying that he's never going to get out of jail, of course there are circumstances that could happen that you brought up. However, more likely than not, he is going to spend the rest of his life in jail, and he will never become subject to the actual conditions because he'll never be on supervised.
But it's not a contingency. It's not a contingency in this case, like the condition that says, well, if someone recommends treatment for him, then he might, you know, then he'll have to do that treatment. Or like the contingency in the Bennett case, where we're not really sure 20 years from now if this particular scientific technique is even going to be valid. There's a contingency there. But where's the contingency here?
Well, with regard to Condition 9, which would require him to undergo a sex-specific assessment, I think you're right, that there is no contingency. If he ever does get out of jail and is on supervised release, then he would be subject to that sex-specific assessment to determine whether or not they mm-hmm. recommend treatment. So I do agree with Your Honor. And I'm happy to move to the merits of the actual case, unless any of the other judges have any questions about the ripeness issue. Moving to the actual merits, I think it's clear here that the court did not abuse its discretion in imposing these two conditions. Condition number 9 simply says that he has to undergo a sex offense-specific treatment, and Judge Timkovich, you had asked if there was any indication in the record that he had ever undergone one. His counsel was asked at the time of sentencing, and what his counsel said...
In this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And what counsel said is, I'm unaware of whether he has, and that was one of the driving reasons why the court felt that it would be appropriate here, because there was no indication that he had ever undergone any type of sex offense assessment to see if treatment would be beneficial to him.
It's a pretty, you know, there's a staleness issue here. It happened a long time ago, and you know, by the time he gets to, let's just set aside murder for now, 20 years from now, I mean, 40-year gap between the sex offense and the assessment, doesn't that kind of run into a staleness, Dugan-type situation?
Well, Your Honor, our position is not in this case. And the reason why is because even though his prior conviction is dated, Mr. Ford has been in jail virtually the entire time since he was found guilty of that conviction until now. The only time he's ever been out of jail were the 3 days that he was on the loose. And I think if you go through the other cases in the Tenth Circuit, for example, the Dugan case, where this court did find an issue with the amount of time, there were periods where Dugan was actually out of jail. And what the Dugan court said is actually when you're looking at whether or not someone has been free of behavior that would call into question their sexual proclivities, you don't ascribe the same weight when they're incarcerated as when they're out in public. Here he's
which,
been in...
Which case says that?
Dugan.
Is that Dugan?
Yes.
Well, but Dugan also said, it said that where the crime of conviction is not a sex crime, and that's what we have here. The crime of conviction is he's a felon in possession, he's a fugitive in possession, right? So no relation to a sex crime. When we have that, in those cases we require a stronger nexus than we have here between the defendant's history and characteristics and the sex offender related conditions. In that case it was 17 years between the time of the conviction, but there had not been any history. We don't have any history here either. And they pointed out in Dugan, just because he's in prison doesn't mean he might not have some related sex offender history. So my point is, what do we have in this case, unlike the Bear and the Mike case that the defendant cites in his brief, where you've got other evidence of sex offender related history? We've got nothing here. And in fact, his original conviction, he was 17 and the victim was 13, so we don't have some of the egregious circumstances that we had like in the Mike case. What gives this case the stronger nexus that we said was required in Dugan?
Well, in Dugan...
Sorry for the long question.
No problem, Your Honor. I mean, I think that there's a couple of distinctions between this case and Dugan. In Dugan, Dugan had a prior sexual battery. Here, Ford's offense was actually against a 13-year-old female. He was 17, but he was tried as an adult, and that is something that the district court specifically brought up when it imposed this sentence. Also in Dugan, Dugan had been out of custody for 7 of the last 17 years.
Right.
Here, Ford hasn't been out of custody at all. And what the Bear case tells us, the Bear court actually found it significant that there was no evidence that the defendant had ever undergone any type of sex offense specific assessment. And so I think if you look at all these cases kind of together and compare...
They had far more troubling facts in Bear and Mike to deal with in terms of the defendant's sexual offense history. We just don't have that here. We just don't have that.
Yes, Your Honor. In Bear, there was repeated instances, and we don't have that here. But what we do have and what the district court specifically referenced when it decided to impose this condition is you have a defendant who was initially charged with a more egregious, actually charged with a rape offense that got pled down to lewd and lascivious acts against a 13-year-old girl. The victim alleged that the conduct was not consensual, it was forcible against her. You have somebody who's been in jail virtually their entire life, and he actually did not finish serving his sentence for that prior, I estimated by my calculation, until about 2016. So even though it's dated, he didn't actually finish that sentence until 2016. He's been incarcerated virtually his entire life, and there's no evidence in the record that he's ever undergone any type of sex offense specific assessment to see if treatment would be amenable. And I think that that condition squarely comports with the mandates that are laid out by Section 3583D. It reasonably relates to the history and characteristics of Ford, to deterrence of his future criminal conduct, and to protection of the public.
So I guess I'm still looking for your answer to what that stronger nexus is, because we've said that nexus is required where the crime of conviction is unrelated to a sex offense. And I guess what you seem to be saying to me is it's the nexus, since it's so remote, his sex offense conviction, is the lack of, during prison, it's the lack of any opportunity to commit a sex offense. So he might have had, we're going to assume that had he been released, perhaps he might have. Is that the nexus?
I think that plays into the nexus. The nexus is he's been incarcerated the whole time, so we don't know
what he... But that doesn't sound like a sufficient evidence of a nexus to me in his character, personal characteristics and history, which is what we were talking about. It's the lack of evidence, so it's something, or potentially the lack of opportunity.
And I think if you're just focusing on that specific finding of Dugan, it ignores all of the other things that this court have said are important when we're looking at this. For example, in Bear, in the Bear case, and I understand that the facts are different. However, the Tenth Circuit did find it significant that the defendant had never undergone any type of treatment like this. And I think in Dugan, another issue at play was there were far more conditions that the defendant was subject to in Dugan for the prior. And so I think part of the concern that the court had there is, okay, just because someone has a prior sex offense, you can't just carte blanche impose all these sex offender conditions of release.
Right.
There has to be a specific reason. Mm-hmm. And if you look back at the record of the reasons articulated by the district court, it's our position that the district court did not abuse its discretion. It clearly articulated why it thought that the only mandatory condition, which is the assessment, was important because he had a prior conviction that involved conduct against a 13-year-old girl, that he had been in prison his whole life, and there was no evidence that he had ever undergone this type of assessment in the future. And what the district court specifically said is that the 10th condition is totally contingent on what the 9th condition says. So I think if you look at all of that, you know, the ultimate question is, did the district court abuse its discretion in imposing this condition?
You may have said this and I missed it. Did the United States ask for this? This was on a resentencing. He was successful in some Johnson litigation, and so he's resentenced. And this occurs at resentencing.
Correct. So this
whose idea was this? I guess is what I'm asking.
The two conditions were recommended by the probation office.
Okay.
So the probation office recommended them. The court imposed them. Ford asked the court, "Why are you imposing this?" And the court went through and gave its reasons. And so our position is that on this record, with these facts, with all the distinguishing factors that we've talked about here today, if you look back at this court's prior precedent, the court did not abuse its discretion, and that the conditions actually comport with the mandates of 3583D.
Thank you.
Unless the court has any additional questions for me, I'm happy to return the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think it's important. We do have some information in the record that is perhaps informative. So in 2009, when Mr. Ford was originally sentenced for this offense under the Armed Career Criminal Statute, the two conditions were recommended by probation but weren't imposed. It was a different trial judge, and it's not clear why the trial judge didn't impose those, but I guess I would suggest he didn't impose them because he didn't think they were reasonable, given Mr. Ford's history. There's also, you know, a woman who was a witness, and I'm forgetting her name, I apologize, but she testified against Mr. Ford, and she helped Mr. Ford and her accomplice, Mr. Bell, with their prison escape. And it got me thinking about, well, you know, there are this notion that there isn't any evidence Mr. Ford committed any sex offense type crimes in prison. I mean, there's a number of ways we can go about that. One, you could get records from the prison if there's any disciplinary history. This woman was an employee of the prison or a contractor with the prison that Mr. Ford and Mr. Bell had befriended. And so, you know, there is access to the chance, I guess, that Mr. Ford could commit some sort of sexual act against an employee or engage in improper sexual conduct in violation of prison rules, even if it's not a crime, things like that that we could get from someone, even if they're in prison, to suggest that they need this type of treatment. And here, you know, the cases are just, his case is just completely different than Bear, who was convicted of failure to register, in addition to having this 12-year-old prior sex offense that involved two minor children over a two-year period of time, and even in Dugan, who the court found it unreasonable to impose it, and he had two prior sex offense convictions as well as failure to register. So I think on the merits, the court can find the district court abused its discretion.
Thank you, counsel. Counselor excused. We appreciate the arguments, and the case shall be submitted.